Chapter 31 Shirley got Archer a gin and tonic and settled him in the back row of a large theater where the dancing girls were in high gear, parading to music played on a baby grand set off to one side of the stage. The pianist was a man in a black tux with a pompadour hairdo, a waxed and curly-tipped mustache, and hands whizzing over the keys like skates over ice. He watched the girls high-kicking it across the stage in unison and seemed to be changing the music to fit the dancing instead of the other way around. All the girls were tall and long-limbed, which, to Archer, made them look a lot like Callahan. He wondered if maybe the competition here was stiffer than in Reno, and he also wondered how her audition was going. The theme was a patriotic one, as the skimpy outfits were embedded with red, white, and blue sparkles, and the top hats were of the Uncle Sam vintage. The legs were encased in fishnets. The shoes were silver and sparkled like diamonds, and every man in the front row was getting an enhanced view with each kick of the long legs and the accompanying lift of the dancer's skirts, all included in the price of admission. 28 minutes went by. Archer checked his timepiece and began to grow a bit anxious, as there was no sign of Callahan. Had she gotten thrown out? And then around 10 or so, the curtains parted, and Archer stiffened and sat up straight, as Callahan walked out onto the stage at the same time the sea of chorus girls scampered off. She was dressed in the outfit Archer had first seen her in at the Dancing Birds Cafe, minus the 6-foot feather. Every eye in the house was on her, including Archer's. She walked over to the pianist, said something to him, quickly skimmed through his music, and tapped her finger against a piece. Then she backed up to the piano, gripped the sides with both hands, and nimbly launched herself on top of it, sitting on her bottom. She crossed her legs and gave a nod to the pianist, and he started tickling the ivories with enthusiasm, perhaps as intrigued as the rest of them with this recent development. When Callahan began to sing, Archer felt chills run up and down his arms. The song was one he knew well. That old black magic. Archer had heard Glenn Miller and his band play that song when he was in London in 1944, after Archer had killed enough Germans to make any humans sick of war. At the end of that year, Miller would die in a plane crash in the English Channel. But that night, the man could do no wrong. The song had sent chills up him that night, too, but not like Callahan's rendition was doing to him. In mid-song, she slunk off the piano and marched across the stage in full command of both it and the audience. As she reached the end of the song, she tipped her head back, showcasing that long, elegantly curved neck, and held the final note for a remarkable period. She then let it die elegantly in her throat, like a thunderstorm dwindling to a gentle rain shower. There was silence for what seemed the longest moment, and then the cheers rained down. The crowd lurched as one to its feet, and thunderous applause filled the room. Hats and flowers and cash were tossed on the stage, along with probably a few business cards and maybe a stray engagement ring or two. Callahan picked up one long-stemmed rose, cuddled it to her bosom, and blew kisses at the audience as she walked off stage, looking like she owned the place. And right then, Archer knew. She did. He felt the tug on his arm. It was Shirley.
"This way,"
she whispered. Shirley led him backstage, where Callahan was sipping a glass of champagne, and Dawson was staring at her like she was a bundle of cash with Dawson's name on it. She looked at Archer as he walked up.
"Okay, she says you're her agent. How much is she going to cost me?"
Archer shot Callahan a glance as she finished her drink and set it down next to the long-stemmed rose. She hiked her plucked eyebrows and said,
"How about it, Archer? What am I worth to a joint like this?"
He didn't hesitate. $250 a week, and she gets Monday and Tuesday off. After 6 months, we look at your books and see what bump in pay she deserves for bringing in new business.
"You're nuts,"
barked Dawson.
"That's what some Hollywood actors make."
"Did you see the audience out there?" said Archer. "Because I did. You'll need to get a bigger room, or squeeze in more seats if you bring her on full time. And if the pie gets larger, it's good for everybody." Callahan looked impressed by this, but said nothing. Dawson glared at Archer, grabbed the bottle of champagne that was chilling in a bucket of ice, and swilled right from it. She pointed at Callahan.
I'll need you to start this Friday. Get here around 5. We have big crowds on Fridays, and then through the weekend, of course. And it'll still give us time to get some posters and billboards up. You're a real pro, so we don't need to prep that much. Hell, you could do what you did tonight, and it'll bring the house down again. You can do a quick rehearsal with the full band, and we can select a rack of songs for you to move through. We might want to throw in some dance moves, too. Nothing too complicated. But I saw how natural you were on stage, so you'll make it look easy. Then you can do your big debut.
And what will the billboards say? Asked Archer.
I don't think they need to say much. They'll just have her picture. I had Barry, our staff photographer, take some stills of Liberty. We'll blow them up and use them on the billboards.
How about something like, if you liked Liberty Bonds, you're going to love this Liberty, suggested Archer.
I like that, Archer. It's catchy,
said Dawson, who then turned to Callahan.
So, how about it?
I don't have a car to get here.
That's not a problem because all of our performers live here. We'll have a nice room for you.
I can go for that,
said Callahan. Archer said, but nicer than what I saw in Ruby Fraser's place, and not in the nosebleed seats.
Okay, okay.
And her own bathroom, added Archer.
I don't even have that.
Archer said nothing.
Okay, okay,
said Dawson again. She glared at Callahan.
If only you weren't so damn talented, I'd throw the pair of you out.
Archer looked at Callahan. Well, your call, boss.
Get the contract printed up, and we're good to go,
said Callahan. Dawson put out a hand for Callahan to shake, which she did.
With the dough we'll be paying you, this is a full-time gig. Starting Saturday, you come in at 4 sharp every day.
She glanced at Archer.
Except Mondays and Tuesdays. You'll start with rehearsal, then eat your meals and do your acts, which will also include some freelancing and playing to the crowd, pictures and handshakes and the like. You'll do 4 to 5 official sets a night, but you work until we say stop, which is usually 2-ish. Understood?
Sure.
Dawson gazed admiringly at her.
I have to admit, I thought you were going to fall flat on your face with your audition.
She looked at Archer.
She sang Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy for me. I think Patty Andrews would have been jealous.
It's a crowd pleaser, Archer, and that's the business I'm in,
said Callahan. Her face was flushed with her triumph, and Archer had to admit it was a good look on the woman.
Well, well, what's all the fuss here? Good tidings, I hope?
The tall man had appeared in the doorway. Archer saw that Dawson's smile faded, and her confident look eroded. She took a step back and stared at the floor.
Hello, Mr. Armstrong. I didn't know you'd be here tonight.
Sawyer Armstrong stood an impressive 6'5". He was lanky and loose-jointed, with long white hair and a beard of the same color that dipped slightly off his lean face. His nose ran a long, crooked line down to nearly his top lip. He wore a brown slouch leather hat, dark denim pants, a white vest with a blue-collared shirt under that, and a brown corduroy jacket with green elbow patches. His skin was weathered and tanned, and the man's features seemed carved with the most precise of instruments wielded by talented hands. The eyes were flints of blue, surrounded by a sea of shimmering white. He sort of looked like Walt Whitman, thought Archer. That is, if Whitman had been a throat slitter instead of a poet. Armstrong put out a hand to Archer.
I'm Sawyer Armstrong. I believe you've talked to my son-in-law, Mr. Archer.
Archer shook hands while casting a look behind Armstrong, where two bulky figures lurked in pinstripes, with bulges at their chests, where large weapons presumably perched. Nice to meet you, Mr. Armstrong. I've heard a lot about you.
I'm sure you have, Archer. You saw my daughter as well, I heard.
Your hearing is real good, then,
said Callahan, drawing Armstrong's attention to her.
And you are?
Liberty Callahan. I'm Archer's best friend. We came to town together. Miss Dawson just hired me to work here.
Did she now? Said Armstrong.
Dawson glanced up, her face full of trepidation, as Archer watched this exchange warily. He had never seen a person change so much as the woman had, and there must be good reason for it. In a timid voice, she said,
I did, Mr. Armstrong. She's quite good. I think she'll really bring in the crowds.
Armstrong studied Callahan for a moment before turning to Archer.
And how is Willie Dash doing?
He's fine. Armstrong put out a thin, long-fingered hand and gripped Archer by the arm.
Let's have a chat, Archer. I have a private room here.
You want some company, Archer?
Said Callahan quickly, and looking uneasily at him. Armstrong answered,
I'm sorry, Liberty. Maybe another time.
Archer said, I'll meet you back at the bar. We'll toast your new career. Callahan gave him a half-smile that sank off her face as quickly as a cement block dropped over the gunwale of a boat.
Sure. Okay.
She glanced behind Armstrong as the two men stepped forward. Both were as tall as Armstrong, but far bulkier, and their faces held nothing approaching human.
I'll come looking for you if you're not there soon,
she added. Armstrong said,
Let's go, Archer.
The two sides of beef immediately stepped forward and marshaled Archer out. Armstrong eyed the two women.
Mabel, we'll talk later.
Yes, sir.
They glanced at Callahan, who stared resolutely back at him. Then, without a word, he followed the others out. Chapter 32 The room was small, dark, and located in the bowels of the place where, Archer presumed, only the rats typically lurked. He was feeling like a trapped one right now. The single bulb illumination overhead gave him no comfort. One of the men, on a sign from Armstrong, searched him, found the .38, pulled it out, and placed it on a table out of Archer's reach, before the other man pushed Archer into a chair. Armstrong sat down in the only other chair in the room, which faced Archer. He glanced at the gun.
Going around armed already? Do you feel that necessary? Are we that dangerous in Baytown?
Archer glanced at the men. And what do they have under their jackets? Lollipops? Armstrong lifted out paper and tobacco from a pouch taken from his jacket pocket, dexterously rolled a small cigarette, and lighted it with a match struck against the table.
The best tobacco in Mississippi, he said in a soothing tone as he sucked in a throatful and then let it ease out into the small space. Have it shipped in monthly. You should try it.
Is there something you wanted to talk to me about? Said Archer. Or am I supposed to just watch you smoke? This statement earned him a staggering blow on the side of the head from one of Armstrong's men that knocked him from his seat. The other man lifted him up and slammed Archer back into the chair. Armstrong made a clucking sound.
Tony is overzealous sometimes in his loyalty to me, Archer, though I can hardly fault him. You understand loyalty, do you not?
When it's explained to me, said Archer, rubbing at his face. A searing pain went from his head to his toes, and the ringing in his ears made it impossible for him to hear the accelerated beats of his own heart.
Well, I can provide that explanation then, said Armstrong, scooching forward a bit on his chair. First of all, loyalty starts at home. I have a daughter whom I cherish, and a son-in-law whom I respect.
Loyalty, okay, that's good to know, thanks. Are we done here? The second blow caught Archer on the other side of the head, and he slumped out of his chair, groaning. When Tony went to pick him up, Archer caught him in the gut with a pinpoint uppercut, doubling the man over and causing him to stagger back and retch up whatever was in his stomach. It came out as a pink slop that hit the floor. The other man grabbed Archer around the neck, lifted him off the floor, and slammed him into the chair. Tony recovered and gave Archer punches in the neck and oblique while the other man held him in place.
Enough! Barked Armstrong.
And the breathless men released Archer and stepped back.
Archer, if you wish to be beaten to death, then by all means carry on as you are. But I see no future in it for you.
Archer fought back the urge to vomit, as the pains continued to radiate from his head and now to his gut and back. With an effort, he managed to sit up straight. He reached into his pocket and took a few moments to pull out a handkerchief, which he used to dab at his mouth. He bent down and picked up his hat from the floor and put it on. So where do I come into all this?
You are investigating the allegations against Douglas?
On his behalf, which makes me wonder what I'm doing here getting my ass kicked by these two gorillas.
What will make me happy, Archer, is that you do not ever question my daughter again. You should not have questioned her in the first place. She is not party to anything that her husband may be involved in. Do you understand that?
Okay, yeah.
And this Ruby Fraser woman?
What about her?
Is she having an affair with Douglas?
He says not, and she says the same.
And what do you say?
I don't know. But if I tell you my opinion, am I going to get slugged again? If so, I'd just prefer to lie. Tony started to swing a fist at Archer, but he ducked out of the way, pivoted on the balls of his feet, came out of the chair, and struck the man flush on the chin with a thunderous blow. Tony staggered back and slammed into the wall. His eyes rolled back into his head, and he slid down the wall unconscious. His legs splayed out, and his pants were edged up enough to reveal the tops of pale, hairy ankles. The other man pulled a black, square-muzzled .45 automatic from his shoulder holster and took aim at Archer's right eye. Armstrong said,
"Put that away, Hank, and give Tony a nip from your flask to revive him, unless you want to carry him out of here."
While Hank did this, Armstrong eyed Archer.
"You pack a pretty big wallop. Good to know."
Archer held up the set of aluminum knuckles he had pulled from his pocket under the guise of getting his handkerchief. Yeah, pretty big.
But getting back to the issue, your opinion?
I haven't looked into it enough to have an opinion. We only started the investigation today. But if you want a half-assed opinion, I'd say there's some truth to it.
But that truth does not have to come out.
We were hired by your son-in-law. I would imagine he gets our report and no one else, so I don't see that as a problem for him and his campaign for mayor.
I don't know about that, but I do know this, Archer. Baytown is a deceitful place with secrets. You'll find that out soon enough.
He paused.
If you make it that long.
I survived the war. I think I can get through this. Armstrong shook his head.
Wars are straightforward. It's you against the men in the other uniform. There is no nuance. There is no need to think about what you need to do. Here it is quite a different scenario. It's a chess match with no room for error.
Yeah, when you say it that way, I can see how that might be. Thanks.
What do you intend to do now?
Continue the investigation.
And what course will it take?
I got a list of people to talk to from Wilson Sheen.
May I see the list?
And if I refuse?
I can assure you that all of our myriad interests are aligned here, Archer.
He glanced at Tony, who had come around with the two pulls in the flask Hank had poured down his throat.
But I can't guarantee that Tony over there will not be so upset at being sucker-punched by you with a pair of aluminum knuckles that he won't resort to drastic actions. I could be wrong. But I wouldn't bet your life on it. Would you?
Archer took out the list and handed it across. Armstrong put on a pair of delicate rimless glasses and read down the names.
Interesting.
He handed the paper back and removed the specs.
Now let me be clear, Archer. We are at a crossroads here. Baytown has unlimited potential. But so do lots of other places. If we do not seize the moment, others will. And what will we be left with? Not much.
What do you want me to do, Mr. Armstrong? I imagine you brought me down here to provide some instruction.
Follow your instincts, Archer. Do your job. Finish your investigation.
And if it comes back against your son-in-law?
I care enough about this town that it takes precedence over family.
After all your talk of loyalty?
The ultimate loyalty is to put the interests of many above your own, and that includes family. If you take away any lesson from this painful episode,
Let it be that. The guy may be cheating on your beloved daughter. How do you respect that?
I have no reason to answer that, and I won't.
He sat back, took off his hat, revealing unruly, thick white hair, and ran his hand through it.
I know you have a client already, but I will pay you as well to follow the trail to the truth, wherever it might lie.
He put his hat on, took out his wallet, and lifted from it a wad of cash.
How much?
You can take that up with Willie, but I'm not sure we can have two clients for the same case. Armstrong put his wallet away, but held out a $50 bill.
I will take it up with Willie, but take this in payment for your assorted injuries. I apologize if you are in real pain.
Archer made no move to take the money. I'll wait to hear from Willie. He glanced at Tony. And that guy doesn't hit hard enough to be worth $50. This comment earned a murderous look from Tony. Armstrong stuck the bill in his pocket.
I like you, Archer. I'm not sure exactly why, but I do. But then my opinion is not set in stone.
His face went dark, and he stood and walked out. Tony and Hank glared at Archer for a moment, as though they were contemplating killing him and wondering what to do with the body. Finally, they followed their boss out. Archer picked up his gun and put it back in the clip holster. He stood up slowly and stretched out his torso, gritting his teeth with the cascading pain. He gingerly readjusted his hat, as though the weight of the fedora was too much for his injured head to bear. He wondered if his skull was fractured, and when he went to bed tonight, whether he would wake up in the morning. He slowly walked out of the room and headed back up to the light of the real world and away from the rats. But instead, maybe he was heading right toward them.
Chapter 33.
Jesus, Archer! Did they do that to you?
Callahan was looking at the purplish bruises on Archer's neck and face as he slowly drained a whiskey sour and ran his tongue over his teeth to make certain they were all still there. He came away unsure. He set the glass down on the bar.
Now I just fell off the roof of this place and landed on somebody's fist, and then I did it three more times.
But why did they work you over?
I'm not sure I have a good answer for that. I'm not sure he did either.
Armstrong, you mean?
Archer nodded and waved to the waitress for a second round. She obliged, and he sipped this one slowly.
Does it hurt much?
Only when I blink.
He rubbed his side where he could feel the swelling. Tony was good. He knew just where to hit to hurt a man. He called the waitress and asked for some ice wrapped in a cloth. The waitress said,
You don't look so good, mister. Were you in an accident?
There was nothing accidental about it.
When she brought the ice in the cloth, he took turns holding it against his face and his neck and his side.
Is that helping?
Asked Callahan.
I'll let you know next week.
Callahan said,
I'm not sure I want to work for a man who beats up my friend.
Thanks for elevating me to the status of a friend. What's the next level after that?
Archer, you know what I mean.
Yeah, sure. We're pals. Always have been, always will be.
You want me to massage where it hurts?
Don't get carried away with all this friendship talk, Liberty. You might start getting ideas, and then I might start getting ideas, and we might end up killing each other over all those ideas.
She pulled her stool closer and said,
I can't believe I actually got the job.
He gave her an incredulous glance.
That's not how you were acting. You seemed really sure of yourself, like you were a shoe-in once Dawson saw your stuff.
Yeah, well, that was just talk. I do that to boost myself up. Inside, I was a wreck.
Good to know that about you. Maybe I do the same.
So do you want to head on back to town?
Not yet. You forgot the other reason we came here.
What was that?
To talk to Ruby Frazier.
He looked at his timepiece.
We missed her show. She might be up in her room. I know where it is. Come on.
He stood and then staggered a bit. She grabbed hold of him.
You sure you're up for this?
No, but I'm going to do it anyway because according to Sawyer Armstrong, I might not get another chance.
Hey, why isn't that jerk Willie Dash out here helping you? What a bum.
He's not a bum. He's also not a well man. He laid the ice and cloth on the table. Now come on. They headed up the stairs and reached the top floor, which was empty at this hour.
How come she has to live all the way up here?
Asked Callahan. This is the hired help section. According to Mabel Dawson, girls here work their way down.
Hey, do you think they expect me to live up here too?
No, you'll get a place with your own bathroom at sea level, remember?
Oh, right. Hey, how come you know so much about negotiating contracts?
I knew what Ruby Fraser was making here. I doubled that amount and added 50 on top for good measure, and nicer lodgings.
Well, aren't you a smart one? But then you are a college boy.
I studied pre-law in college, even worked for a lawyer during the summer. Got to see the law up close and personal.
So you wanted to be a lawyer?
He lit up a Lucky and blew out smoke. I was a lawyer, of sorts, back in Poca City.
What'd you do there?
Kept myself from being hanged.
That's funny, Archer.
It wasn't funny at the time. Archer led the way down the hall to Fraser's door. He knocked, but no one answered.
She doesn't seem to be here,
said Callahan, staring at the door.
Maybe she's off doing another show. Like Dawson said, they keep performing until around two-ish.
Archer knocked harder. Ruby, it's Archer. We need to talk. There was still no answer. He said, We can look for her downstairs and then ask around. Maybe she's doing another number, like you said, but I'd like to leave a note inside her room. He tried the door. It was unlocked. He pushed it open and walked in. Callahan nervously followed.
Archer, I'm not sure we should be doing this.
It'll be fine. Archer turned on a table lamp and took out his notepad and pen, only he found that in the skirmish with Hank and Tony, the point had been broken off his pen. Check in the kitchen for something to write with. I'll look in the bedroom. Archer walked into the tiny bedroom and noted that the bed was made, but the room was messy, with clothes and shoes everywhere. He found a pen in the nightstand next to the Gideon Bible and had turned to leave when Callahan filled the doorway like a tsunami coming right for him. Her face was drained of all color, and she looked like she might be sick. What is it? He asked sharply. She stepped aside and pointed to her left with one hand while holding her stomach with the other.
In there,
she said, her voice brimming with dread. Archer raced past her and into the kitchen. The room was illuminated by a single overhead bulb, but Archer could see enough. Ruby Fraser was all dressed up, probably for her big number tonight. She was sitting in a chair that was pushed back against the wall. Her head was slightly tilted back, her long legs splayed out in front of her, and the woman's wide eyes were full upon Archer. Still, she could not see him. Ruby Fraser could no longer see anything. He gingerly stepped forward and bent down so he could ascertain more closely what had killed her. It wasn't difficult. Her throat had been cut so brutally that he could glimpse white bone through the fresh opening. The cut disappeared around both sides of her neck and ran along the back to nearly her spine. Another 6 inches, and she would have lost her head entirely. The woman had not been killed here. There was no blood on the floor, table, or walls, though the front of her dress was coated with it, transforming white to crimson. He felt her wrist. It was ice cold. He checked his watch. It was 10 to 12. If she had done her show at 10, and it had taken a half hour or so, how could she be killed, moved, and cold as ice barely an hour or so later? He lifted her arm. It moved freely. He replaced it exactly where it was.
Don't do that, Archer. Don't touch her. It's not right.
He turned to see Callahan staring dully at the dead woman from the doorway.
She was really pretty,
said Callahan in a hushed voice.
And really young.
Yeah, she was, said Archer, taking a few steps back.
Poor kid. Who could have done this?
What I want to know is how could somebody move a dead body in here and nobody see it? The lack of blood shows she was killed somewhere else. Callahan still looked like she might be sick.
What do we do now? Call the cops?
There's a phone booth right off the front entrance. I'll make the call from there.
Will you tell the police who you are?
My morals say yes. My survival instinct says no.
I always go with survival.
Let's blow this joint before somebody sees us. As they turned to leave, Archer looked back at Fraser and said quietly, I'm sorry, Ruby. Nobody deserves to go out like that. Before they left, Archer took out a handkerchief and rubbed at all the places they had touched, including the doorknobs.
What are you doing?
Asked Callahan. Getting rid of our fingerprints.
What for?
Because in the state of California, they can send you to the gas chamber. That's what for. Chapter 34 Archer stepped into the phone booth, dropped in a coin, covered the receiver with his handkerchief, and dialed in the number for the police he'd found in the phone book dangling from a chain on the booth's inner wall. When the voice came on the line, Archer told the person about the body at Midnight Moods, giving the room location. He hung up, put his handkerchief away, and stepped out, pale and aching from his earlier beating. Callahan was standing next to the booth and watching him carefully.
Well?
A radio patrol car should be here shortly.
And where will we be? Long gone from here, I hope.
Give me a minute. I want to check something.
What?
Something that's bugging me timing-wise. They found Mabel Dawson in her office. She looked up from her desk where she was writing something on a piece of paper.
I don't have the contract ready yet, Archer. I'm talking to the lawyer tomorrow, so just hold your horses. And we don't advance money on any contract, if that's what you're thinking.
No, it wasn't that. I wanted to speak with Ruby Fraser. Do you know where she might be? I've been looking around, but no one's seen her. She put her pen down and frowned.
Now I'm really starting to get worried. She didn't turn up for her show tonight.
She didn't?
You know she didn't.
He shot Callahan a glance. How would I know that? Said Archer. Dawson rubbed her forehead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I guess you wouldn't know. Well, it was because Liberty took Ruby's slot. That's why I had her go out on stage tonight. I mean, why'd you think I'd do something like that?
Wait a minute. You mean to tell me that Liberty sang in place of Ruby?
Yes, it was the only thing I could think of. I didn't have anybody else worth anything to stand in for her. Ruby has good pipes, but nothing like Liberty. So I told Liberty to go out on stage to Michael. He's the pianist, and find a song she knew. And that's what she did.
I thought you were just putting me on the spot to test me,
said Callahan.
Well, maybe there was a little bit of that. But the main thing was I needed a singer to cover for Ruby.
Did anyone check her room? Asked Archer slowly, as he inwardly cringed at the mention of Fraser's pipes.
Yeah, I did, before I made the decision to use Liberty.
What time?
I got a message from the stage manager right after Liberty finished her audition that Ruby hadn't turned up for her warm-up. So I went looking for her, starting with her room. The door was locked, but I have a key. I thought maybe she was sick or had overslept or something. I went in, but there was no one there.
Archer glanced at Callahan once more. And no one had seen her?
No. I thought she might have gone off somewhere with someone and left me in the lurch.
Why would you think that? Asked Archer in a sharp tone. Dawson looked at him warily.
No reason, Archer.
Come on, Mabel. We're all friends here.
Ruby liked men.
Any men in particular?
Rich men,
said Dawson. Okay, I guess that narrows it down. Any rich man in particular?
You're the gumshoe. I'll let you figure that out.
She sat back, a look of clarity spreading over her features.
So that's why you were out earlier talking to her. It was about some man she might be seeing.
It might have been. So what's the deal with Sawyer Armstrong? She eyed his damaged face and then ran her gaze over his stiffened posture.
Maybe I should be asking you the same thing.
I understand he built this place.
Before the war started.
Is Armstrong married?
What do you care?
I'm just trying to get some information. That's what private detectives do.
His wife, Eleanor, died in a plane crash a couple years ago.
Do you know Beth Kemper or her husband? She laughed.
I don't move in those sorts of exalted circles.
I understand that Douglas Kemper comes here to play cards, and maybe for other things.
Maybe you understand that. I don't.
Meaning?
Meaning I'm not getting involved. If you have any other questions, ask somebody else.
Okay. Well, if Ruby turns up, let her know that I want to talk to her.
Dawson looked at Callahan.
Don't be late on Friday, Liberty. We need to sign your deal and get things sorted out.
They left, got into the Delahay, and were driving out when the first patrol car came flying up the road and passed them heading to the entrance. As they made their way down the road, two more prowlers sailed past them, their lights flinging away the gloomy darkness and the sirens cutting through the sounds of the breakers off in the distance.
What now, Archer?
Said Callahan. Now we go back to the boarding house.
You want to go get a drink?
No, I've had enough.
Okay, I guess I can understand that. I just feel bad leaving her there like that.
He gripped her shoulder. Get that out of your mind, and don't slip up if anybody asks you, Liberty. We didn't go up there, and we didn't see anything. You got that square?
Sure, Archer, sure.
Because if the police start asking questions and you mess up, we're both in trouble. Big trouble. They rode the rest of the way back in silence. Chapter 35. A distraught Callahan had gone to her room, and Archer to his. He got undressed and climbed into bed, but he couldn't sleep. He felt that if he closed his eyes, they wouldn't reopen, and his whole body ached even more. It was nearly 2 in the morning now, but he rose, padded down to the bath, and splashed cold water on his face and neck. He went back to his room, slipped on the same clothes, and laced up his shoes. He opened the window and looked out. Even from the other side of Sawyer Avenue, he could hear the beat of the ocean, smell its pungent scent, and feel the mist from the marine fog that chilled him to the bone and made his injuries more painful still. He pulled his PI license from his jacket pocket and looked at it. Though it looked official and important, it represented nothing to him, really, because he'd done nothing to earn it. This could have been handed out to any Tom, Dick, or Harry. Or Aloysius. He was a Seamus solely under the auspices of Willie Dash. Anyone could be under the auspices. It was like hitching a ride in someone's car and then claiming you owned it. He pulled his pocket flask, and despite telling Callahan he'd had his fill, he took several swallows of rye whiskey, which flamed his already inflamed body. It felt good, as though it was fire of his own making, and not a byproduct of another man's angry attack. He closed the window and went downstairs as quietly as he could. He had no desire to run into Callahan or anyone else, but that desire was to be defeated. In the front room, Madame Genevieve sat in an upholstered chair, wearing a thick woolen robe and frayed white slippers. She was nursing what looked like a hot toddy in a clear glass mug with a handle. Her hair was mostly hidden under an old-fashioned cloth sleeping bonnet. Her ankles protruded from the robe and were bony and the color of the dead. She looked up at him.
You cannot sleep, Mr. Archer?
He leaned against the stair post and shook his head. Might just be the new place.
Your friend does not appear to have that difficulty. I passed her door earlier and heard the snores. Soft, but still audible.
Well, she had a big night. We both did. Archer sat down in a chair across from her. So what are you doing up? Can't sleep either?
I like this time of night. There is no one around and it is quiet. I can think. But I can also open the window, and I can hear the water speaking to me. I can smell it. I can let it embrace me like a shroud.
How many of those drinks have you had? Archer said with a grin.
It is not alcohol that speaks, Mr. Archer.
What then?
Perhaps it is the wisdom of an old woman who has seen much. Perhaps too much.
She cradled her drink.
What are you really doing in Baytown?
Got a job. I'm a private eye, working for Willie Dash. You know him?
I've seen the billboards. And do you like being a private investigator?
He shrugged. I haven't been doing it long enough to really know. But it has its good points and bad points. He rubbed his neck. I saw the bad points a few hours ago. He looked down at his shoes. Look, you know anything about Sawyer Armstrong or Beth and Douglas Kemper?
Everyone in Baytown knows of them.
But you don't know them?
I don't know them. Not really.
She said these words as though they were distasteful, lingering in her mouth for even a moment. You trying to tell me something? If so, I'd prefer if you just say it.
I will not say anything of the sort. I live here. I have a business here that I need to operate in order to survive.
We have the right to speak our minds in this country, She glanced dourly at him.
Free speech is not really free if it costs you all that you have.
Care to elaborate? She shook her head and held the glass against her withered cheek. Douglas Kemper is running for mayor, said Archer.
I know.
Thinking of voting for him, or for the dentist he's running against, Alfred Drake?
I haven't thought much about it, quite frankly. I liked our last mayor.
Archer perked up. And who was that?
Benjamin Smalls. He was honest. He did right by the people.
Why isn't he running again, then?
He died while in office just a month ago. The upcoming election is a special election. The winner will finish out Smalls' term, which is 3 more years.
Archer squinted at her. How'd he die?
They say he drowned in his bathtub.
They say? You don't know for sure?
I don't know for sure, because the police don't know for sure. No one apparently knows for sure. The only thing they know for sure is that Benjamin Smalls is dead.
People do drown in their bathtubs.
Yes, I suppose they do.
I guess maybe he was old or drunk. She rose, went over to a bureau, opened the drawer, and took out a framed photo.
This is Benjamin Smalls. He was 35 and a teetotaler.
Archer looked at the photo that was signed to her and studied Smalls. He was tall, with slicked-back dark hair parted on the side. He had a dimple under his chin that must have been annoying to shave. He also had nice, comely features and wore a white linen suit with a Panama hat held in one hand. This was actually the second time he had seen a picture of the man.
That photo was taken last year, when he won re-election.
Maybe he died of a seizure then, or a heart attack.
The police could find no evidence of that.
Archer pulled out a Lucky and lit up, catching the ash in his hand. You seem to think there was more to it.
You're a private eye. Maybe you should turn your eye to that.
I think I have enough on my plate. She shrugged.
Why do you want to know about Armstrong and the Kempers?
Something to do with my investigation.
Then I would be careful if I were you. Very careful.
I'm starting to figure that out. He didn't think she could see the bruises on his face and neck in the dim light, but maybe she had better vision than he was giving her credit for. I might go for a stroll. Is it safe out there at night?
Is anywhere safe at night, Mr. Archer?
He tipped his hat and left her there with her toddy and her moody introspection. Outside, he headed towards Sawyer Avenue, lighting another cigarette on the way and feeling for the gun in the belt holster. Its presence lifted his spirits considerably. And if he ran into Tony or Hank again, he planned to shoot first and ask not a single question later. There was no one out and about that he could see. All shops were closed at this hour, even the ones that, when open, catered solely to the baser pleasures of its patrons. A sliver of moon crept out from behind the clouds and cast a delicate glow over Baytown. A prowler slowly pulled up to him. He tipped his hat to the officer, who stared suspiciously at him from the passenger seat. Archer tried to remain calm, but his aching body was stiffening all over with anxiety, and for an obvious reason. Could this be about Ruby Fraser? Could they be here to arrest me? Everything okay, Bob? Asked the cop, giving Archer a once-over. Yes, sir, officer. Just got into town and couldn't sleep. Thought I'd walk around and get the lay of the land. The cop at the wheel leaned forward so as to be in Archer's line of vision. That wouldn't include casing any joints, would it? But he smiled to show he was kidding. Only the best liquor joints, but that can wait until the sun comes up, he said, grinning back, but his heart beat even harder. They drove off and picked up his pace. He wondered how many cops were up at midnight moods right now. Maybe every one of them besides these two yokels. Crossing Sawyer Avenue, he turned away from the fancy areas of Furs and Tees and Bentleys and headed to the working-class wharf. He wanted to hear the breakers better and smell the salt air with more vigor. He had no idea why. He just did. Maybe it would help him not to think of dead Ruby. He reached the wharf after a brisk walk of 15 minutes, during which he saw not another soul or another car, prowler or not. Baytown was clearly bedded down for the night. He walked along the pier and finally settled on a bench built into the wooden wall there, and which looked directly out to sea. The territory of Hawaii was out there, he knew, thousands of miles away. And beyond that, and more thousands of ocean miles, was Japan, which was still no doubt licking its war wounds after having two atom bombs dropped on it 4 years ago. Archer was just glad he hadn't had to fight his way to mainland Japan. He'd had enough of war to last him forever. Any man who had seen and done what he had would feel the same way. And if they didn't, there was something wrong with them that nothing could fix except copious amounts of booze. He figured if Prohibition were still in place after the war, America would be no more. They would have rolled up the carpet and headed for Europe, where a man could get a decent shot of booze and a kind word from a woman at any time of the day or night. The breakwater built out parallel to the land was made of enormous boulders, which, like an iceberg, was just the tip of the rock out there. He started staring at the jetty and the moored boats bobbing slightly, and worked through two more cigarettes and half his flask while he listened to the waves leisurely hitting the rocks and let the salt air carve his inside smooth. The moon cast finger shadows over the water. The Pacific was basically flat and calm, the air not moving much, no storm clouds overhead to cause trouble. He might just sit here until sunrise and surprise the longshoremen and fishermen on their way to work. He closed his eyes and let his thoughts wander. A few minutes later, he opened them, and his thoughts focused on one thing. It was constant and perfectly replicated, meaning it was mechanical. As he continued to listen and watch, the motorboat came into view. There was a spotlight deployed on its bow, and the light gashed over the water as it tried to discern solids from fluids. As it came more fully into view and passed the breakwater, and started navigating through the minefield of moored boats, he could see that it was about 25 feet long, and there were a number of people on board. It veered southward as it approached the pier and ran parallel to it for about 200 yards until it was well away from the port operations. A minute before this, Archer had taken to his heels and was jogging along in that direction. He reached a spot where he took up position behind a waist-high wall and eyed the boat as it docked at a pier. Two men got off and secured the boat's lines to the dock cleats. Then the bow light was extinguished, and more people got off. Archer continued to watch as they walked toward the lot adjacent to where Archer was hidden. He sank lower, turned his head, and saw two vehicles parked there. As the men drew closer to the cars, another automobile came down the wharf road, turned, and pulled into the parking lot. Due to the thrust and reach of its headlights, the group from the boat was fully revealed to him. The tall figure of Sawyer Armstrong was prominent among them, as were his two goons, Tony and Hank. And there were three other men that Archer didn't recognize. The car pulled to a stop, but kept on its headlights. Stepping out of the car was another person that Archer did know. Beth Kemper hurried over to her father, and they held a quick and apparently heated conversation, at least by their body language, because Archer could hear none of it. The brief meeting ended with Armstrong and his group climbing into the two cars and driving off, leaving Kemper alone. Archer saw the dot of flame emerge as the woman lit a cigarette and leaned against her car, which he now recognized as the little Triumph Roadster convertible he'd seen back at the Kemper estate. The woman stared out at the ocean and smoked her cigarette, while Archer continued to watch and contemplated what to do. Part of him wanted to approach her, see what was going on. But his professional instincts, such that he had, told him that would be the wrong move for any number of reasons. If he did that, and she told her father that Archer had seen them come in on the boat from God knew where in the middle of the night, Archer figured he would get another visit from Tony and Hank, and it would be his last visit with anyone ever. His final resting place might be the very same ocean Beth Kemper was staring at, with cement shoes encasing his feet as he sank to the bottom to realize his new destiny as plankton. She dropped her finished cigarette and scrunched it flat with the heel of her shoe, then got into her car and drove slowly off. Archer swiftly moved after the convertible. He knew full well there was no way he could really follow her on foot if she sped up and vanished from sight. Fortunately, she didn't go far. As Archer trotted along behind, she drove only 3 blocks before she parked the car at the curb and got out. 2 motorcycles, one with a sidecar, were pulled up on the pavement in front. Archer eyed the 24-hour sign of the restaurant as she walked in. He waited for a few minutes and followed. Chapter 36 Archer stood in the doorway of the hole-in-the-wall diner. Its yellow, pebbled floors were sticky linoleum, its booths shiny red vinyl, its tabletops slapdash laminate of no memorable design, and its walls painted a seafoam green with the overhead whirly fans moving at the pace of a man with nowhere to go. There was a jukebox, but it was as dark and silent as the night. There were three other customers in the place besides Beth Kemper. All three were around 19 or 20, and all were clustered around her booth, apparently giving the lady trouble, while a flustered waitress in her 40s hovered nearby, looking uncertain as to what to do. Archer heard one of the young men, tall and pudgy with a crew cut and muscled arms and shoulders showing under his t-shirt, say,
"Hey, baby, we got some gin back at our place. You need to join us. Good times, sugar doll, good times."
His skinny, acneed friend laughed and parroted,
"Good times, sugar doll."
"Sure like to see your games without anything on 'em," said Crewcut. "Bet they're a knockout like you."
The third man was lean and lanky, had dark greased hair, and wore denim jeans stiff as a 2x4, scuffed black motorcycle boots, and a brown leather bomber jacket. The fanned-out top half of a switchblade stuck out of his rear pants pocket like a cobra's head. Kemper, for her part, was smoking another cigarette and looking extremely bored. She seemed to perk up when she saw Archer coming.
"Mrs. Kemper," said Archer, walking over.
All of the men turned to eye him, and there wasn't a friendly look in the bunch, which was no surprise, thought Archer.
What guy liked his crude lovemaking interrupted?
Crewcut said, "Hey, bud, we're having a talk with the lady here, so take a powder."
Archer drew closer. "That's funny. I have a scheduled meeting with the lady."
"Scram," said Switchblade, transferring an unlit cigarette from between his lips to behind his right ear, as though that movement constituted a plain threat. Archer moved closer while Kemper continued to eye him with interest.
"Don't make this difficult, boys," he said.
Crewcut seemed to take this reference personally, because he shoved acne aside and said,
"Who you calling a boy, Mac?"
Archer looked around and shrugged.
"We seem to be the only males here, so I'll leave it to you to figure out."
Kemper snorted at that one, which only made Crewcut angrier.
"You know him?"
he demanded, wheeling around on Kemper. She smiled benignly and waved her cigarette smoke away from her.
"Not as much as I'd like to."
Confused by this, Crewcut turned and shot Switchblade a glance along with a jerk of the head in Archer's direction that could not have been clearer. Archer sighed. If he had a sawbuck for every time he'd seen that same look communicated in that same clumsy fashion. Switchblade went for his knife, but before he could open the blade, Archer laid him out with a punch so hard it knocked him into the next booth. He lay there, his nose bloody, a tooth wobbly, and his mind crushed into unconsciousness. Crewcut screamed profanities and drew a fist back. Archer swept aside the front of his jacket where the .38 sat prominently. Crewcut froze. Archer said, "You want to see my credentials now or wait until after you get booked for harassing this lady and trying to have your buddy knife me?"
Acne said fearfully,
You're a cop, mister?"
Archer didn't even bother to look at him. He kept his gaze on Crewcut with his fist still cocked. "In the meantime, unless you want your parents to have to spend their hard-earned money bailing you boys out, grab your friend, throw some cold water in his face, get on your tricycles out there and beat it. Now!" Crewcut and Acne grabbed their knocked-out chum and slid him out the door. About 30 seconds later, Archer heard the bikes fire up. He went to the door and watched them ride off. Switchblade was slumped in the sidecar, as both bikes disappeared into the night with their owners' egos tucked between their legs. The waitress said,
"Gee, thanks, mister. They've been nothing but trouble all night."
"No problem. Can I get a cup of Joe? Rumbling punks is thirsty work."
"Coming right up, and it's on the house."
She went off to get the coffee while Archer walked back over to the booth, shaking out his achy hand.
"Mrs. Kemper," he said again.
She looked up at him, her expression one of intrigue.
"Mr. Archer, why don't you join me for our scheduled meeting?"
He slid into the booth, took off his hat, and set it next to him.
"That was impressive, and I so like to see a man enjoy his work."
He ran his eye over her. She was dressed far more casually than last time. flared white pants with black buttons on the side, a checkered cotton shirt in blue and gold, a kerchief at her neck, and a fitted dark blue jacket over both, and a pair of gold hoops graced her delicately lovely ears. Surprised to see you here.
As I am seeing you.
She tapped ash into the ashtray.
I hope you haven't been following me,
she said with enough behind it to put Archer on his guard.
Following you,
he said with feigned incredulity that he hoped was genuine enough to carry away her suspicions. That's your car outside. I recognized it from my visit to your house. If I'd been following you, you would have either seen my headlights, since there are no other cars out there, or heard my car. Did you hear a car behind you?
No, I didn't.
I walked here from my place over on Porter, asked my landlady for a place to eat. I woke up in the middle of the night all hungry. Turns out she's a night owl. She recommended here.
Porter Street. Why didn't you drive?
Because I wanted to walk and smoke, and it's not that far. Your trip here was a lot farther. Must be tough navigating those switchbacks in the dark and the fog.
He pulled the ashtray closer, lit up, and tapped ash into it as his coffee arrived. It was hot and good.
What? No notepad to write down my answers?
She said mockingly as the waitress departed.
I'm off duty.
I didn't come from my home,
said Kemper.
Really? Where then?
That's no concern of yours.
You're right, it's not.
I spoke to my father. Have you heard the news?
He exhaled smoke and shook his head.
What news?
There was a murder.
Archer furrowed his brow and said sharply,
A murder? Where?
At Midnight Moods.
Hell, I was there last night, meaning about 5 hours ago. Went there with a friend who was auditioning for a job. Who got killed?
Ruby Frazier.
Archer let his jaw go slack, and he laid his smoke on the lip of the ashtray before clasping his hands on the table and assuming what he hoped was a judicious look.
The Ruby Frazier?
Yes, the same one you were asking me about yesterday.
How did she die?
My father didn't say.
When was she killed?
She spread her hands and shook her head.
Who killed her? He persisted.
Apparently no one knows.
Where exactly was she found?
Archer was asking all the questions he would have asked of someone else if he hadn't known what had happened.
I think in her room.
How come your father knows all those details?
She gazed at his injuries.
Come on, Mr. Archer. Don't play me for a dope. You ran into my father there, and your face ran into the fists of two of his thugs.
Archer rubbed his bruises.
And did he tell you why that happened?
He told you to stop bothering me.
Let's hope he doesn't walk in the door here, then. I might not get out alive.
Don't make jokes like that.
Why? Does your old man have a habit of knocking people off?
I'm not going to dignify that with an answer.
I was surprised to learn he owned Midnight Moods.
She gave him a hard look.
He owns most of the town, so stop being surprised.
Your husband is giving him a run for his money, though. A winery, the fancy-schmancy Mayport Hotel, a country club on the water. He runs a very efficient office. I met Wilma Darling. She could have been a ship's captain 200 years ago. There never would have been even a hint of mutiny with her at the helm. I don't know why he needs Sheen around with that gal on the job.
You know, I've wondered that myself.
She took a sip of her coffee and took out a fresh cigarette. Archer pulled out a match, struck it against the side of the table, and leaned over to light her smoke. She lightly cupped his hand while he did so. They moved apart, their gazes averted after the intimacy of the subtle embrace. Archer dropped the spent match into the ashtray and waited.
Where is Mr. Dash, by the way?
I hope asleep in bed. Why does your husband even want to be mayor?
Did you ask him?
I'm asking you.
Afraid I can't help you there. I haven't asked him either.
Could it be your father's doing?
In what way?
Get your husband into the mayor's office, help out his business interests.
I'm not sure my father needs help in that regard.
Did you know Benjamin Smalls? Archer asked abruptly.
Why do you ask?
She said warily.
I saw his picture on the table in your library. It was signed To Beth, All My Best Wishes, Ben. It was right next to Jimmy Stewart's mug.
I knew Ben, yes.
He died about a month ago?
That's right. He drowned in his tub.
So everyone keeps saying.
What does that mean?
It means that's what everyone keeps saying.
You don't believe it?
Well, I wasn't there to see it for myself.
You don't accept things as facts unless you see them. You've got a long road ahead of you.
How'd you know him?
Ben's father, Andrew, was partners with my father. He's dead now.
I thought the Armstrong family had plenty of dough to do what they wanted.
Andrew was a state senator and thus very well connected in Sacramento.
But he's dead?
He killed himself.
How? Asked the startled Archer.
They found him hanging in his barn.
She dipped her head and wouldn't look at him. She drew down thoughtfully on her cigarette.
With Ruby Fraser dead, things get complicated for you, don't they?
Archer said, I think they get complicated for a lot of people, you included.
Me? What makes you say that?
Your hubby was maybe having an affair with her, and maybe you knew about it. That's what they call a prime motive. Have the cops been by to see you?
Maybe I have an alibi, or didn't I tell you?
How can you have an alibi when no one knows when she was killed?
Apparently the police have a time window. I was at a dinner party from 5 in the evening until after midnight. In fact, I left for it right after you and your colleague finished interrogating me.
Not right after, because you changed clothes. You had on a dress before, not pants.
I went to the party in my dress. You don't wear an outfit like this to a dinner party. I changed into these clothes afterward.
Did your father tell you about the time window?
I don't remember who did.
And if your father did know, how would he know?
He has a direct line to the chief of police. They're old friends.
And what's his name?
Carl Pickett.
If the dinner party ended at midnight, what did you do between leaving there and coming here?
I went to a place with the thought of going to bed, and then decided I wanted to get out. I like the coffee here.
What place did you go to with the thought of going to bed?
It's here in town. I've owned it since before I was married. It's my little hidey hole.
Over 99% of all dirty laundry gets lost in them. She puffed on her cigarette.
What a wonderfully lurid imagination you have.
When you were deciding to go to bed, were you alone?
Don't get cute. It's not a good look for you.
Yeah, I've heard that line before. She stubbed out her smoke in the ashtray.
It really was quite masterful how you handled those men. 3 against 1.
I probably could have huffed and puffed and blew them all into the Pacific from here. He tapped out his smoke, too. Does your husband have an alibi for tonight?
I don't know. I haven't seen him.
Does he have a hidey hole in town, too?
I wouldn't know.
He cocked his head as he peered at her. Why do you put up with it? They have divorce in California, I take it.
It's not as easy as you might imagine.
If you can prove he two-timed you, Mrs. Kemper, you can get a divorce.
Maybe I like my life how it is. He goes his way, and I go mine. How would divorce change that?
If you're okay with it, who am I to judge?
But you will, anyway.
Nah, I'm too busy. Besides, he must have some feelings for you.
What makes you say that?
She said quickly. Her features tightened, and the look on her face was, at least to Archer's mind, caught between hopeful and hopeless. I saw a bottle of his wine, the BK. Stands for Beth Kemper, right? Her features relaxed, and all the light went out of her eyes.
Wrong. It stands for Best Kemper.
He studied her closely before saying, Sorry, my mistake.
Yes, it is.
She rose and looked down at him.
Do you need a lift back to where you're staying on dear old Porter Street?
Your triumph's not very big, Mrs. Kemper. Things might get pretty tight in there.
Make it, Beth. And don't you know? Wonderful things come in small packages.
Chapter 37. Have you always lived in Baytown? Asked Archer as Beth Kemper started the triumph and pulled out from the curb. He had helped her put the top down because it was such a fine night. The wind whipped Kemper's hair, and a few errant strands landed across Archer's face. Lilac, he thought, as he leaned away from its clutches.
Yes, my father was born here. His family's been here for generations.
Willie Dash mentioned something about the cattle business from a long time ago.
My grandfather, Atticus, raised and sold cattle, as did his father before him, and so on and so on. Then he started investing in real estate, among other things.
My father took over the family business when Atticus died. This was a long time ago. My grandfather died before I was even born. That's when my father and Andrew Small started working together. My mother, Eleanor, was born and raised in Seattle, but her family moved here when she was a teenager. She and my father met here and got married.
I understand she died in a plane crash. Was it a passenger airliner? In a somber tone, Kemper said,
No, it was her plane. She was a licensed pilot.
Female pilot? That's pretty nifty. Kemper smiled sadly.
I used to go up with her all the time. My father was quite a bit older than she was. She had me when she was 21. I couldn't imagine having a baby of my own at that age. She volunteered to fly during World War II, but they said she was too old. She was really upset about that. She used to be a barnstormer and trick pilot in the 1920s. She was really amazing.
So what happened?
We don't know. It was a terrible accident. She was flying in her plane, a Stearman 75. It was a military trainer plane, but after the war they were sold to civilians, and my mother bought one. She named it Elizabeth, after me, her only child.
She must have loved you very much, observed Archer quietly. She shot him a glance as though to check whether he was being sincere or not.
No more than I did her. Anyway, it was a two-seater, single-prop biplane. She could make it do anything she wanted. I was supposed to go up with her that day. It was beautifully clear. But Douglas had arranged a luncheon with some important clients and insisted that I be there. So my mother went up, all alone.
She slowed the triumph and put a trembling hand to her face.
It's been 2 years. You'd think I would have gotten past this.
It's okay, said Archer. I don't think you ever get past it. He pulled out his flask and handed it to her. Rye whiskey always works for me. She took a sip and let it go down very slow. She handed back the flask.
Thank you. That does do the trick.
The smell of the ocean hit them as they rounded a curve and the Pacific came into view. The breakers were rolling in hard and grinding the sand into even smaller particles. Did you learn how to fly? He asked.
No, I don't like to fly, really. In fact, I only flew with her.
What about your husband? You said he was a pilot.
After the war, he said he never wanted to get in another airplane. He was shot down, landed in the Pacific, and floated in a raft for 2 weeks before being rescued.
I had some plane trouble in the war, too.
But with my mother in the cockpit, I was never worried or anxious. She would do barrel rolls and loop the loops and dives, and I would be screaming and laughing at the same time. It was the most exhilarating, the most...
She stopped and looked at Archer, her cheeks flushed.
I don't usually go on and on like that with someone I barely know.
Yeah, I saw that personality trait the first time we met, but this is the second time, so there's that. She smiled.
Are you going to make me change my opinion of you, Archer?
Oh, let's hope it doesn't come to that. She laughed. But not being a pilot, there was nothing you could have done to save your mother that day, if that's what's hanging around your neck. You both would have died. Her laugh died in her throat, and her face flamed. She snapped.
You don't know that. You have no way of knowing that. You couldn't—
He interjected. I spent 3 years in Europe playing the what-if game. If I'd only heard the sound a second later, or aimed a little less sharply, or turned left instead of right, I'd be dead instead of the other guy. They can eat you up if you let it. So don't let it eat you up. From what you've said about your mother, she wouldn't have wanted that for you. She slowed the car again and looked at him. And this time it seemed to Archer that Beth Kemper was actually seeing him for the very first time.
I didn't expect such nuance from you, Archer.
I almost never expect it from myself. Sometimes it just pops out all by its lonesome. She smiled and dabbed at her eye with her knuckle. She glanced to her left toward the ocean.
She crashed about 2 miles off the coast. They found the wreckage the next day. People saw the plane just go into a dive. She never parachuted out. I guess she didn't have time. She wasn't flying that high.
I'm really sorry, Beth.
The news reached me when we got home from the luncheon. I couldn't believe it. Not at first. They never did find her body. The water is very deep out there, and undercurrents are very fast.
She hit the gas and they sped up.
And from that moment on, my marriage seemed more a burden than a blessing.
I doubt your husband wanted anything to happen to your mother.
They got along all right, actually. More than Douglas and my father do.
But your husband must owe a lot to your father. I mean, it must have helped his business prospects to have Sawyer Armstrong as his father-in-law.
I believe Douglas thinks he's paid back any debt in spades. And maybe he has.
How long have you two been married?
Nearly 8 years. I met Douglas while I was in college. It seemed like a perfect match. We married after I graduated.
Any kids running around?
No. Douglas, no. We don't plan to have a family.
You're still young if you change your mind.
That won't be happening.
She said nothing else, and Archer could think of nothing else to say. So they rode the rest of the way with only the Triumph's engine noise in their ears. When they reached Porter Street and the boarding house, Archer climbed out and tipped his hat. Thanks for the ride.
I don't make it to this side of Sawyer Ave much. It's nice.
You don't have to say that to make me feel better. I don't have a horse in that race.
What will you do now?
Sleep. Then I'll hook up with Willie Dash and see where we go from there. He might not know about Ruby Frazier.
This blackmail scheme, was she involved in it?
She said not, but who knows?
But with her dead, does that mean the blackmail plan will fall apart?
You would think so, but honestly, my gut tells me no.
You follow your gut?
It usually points me in the right direction, and I haven't found anything better yet.
Well, maybe I should follow my gut more. Good night, Archer.
Good night, Beth. She pulled off, and he watched the little Triumph spurt along, and her long hair trailing out with the car's wake until it turned at an intersection and she disappeared. Maybe back safely on the other side of Sawyer Avenue to her hidey hole, where she would go to bed alone or with someone else. Or maybe the lady was going to go all the way back up the mountain and lose herself in her gated estate built by Daddy, with the letter A all over the place to remind her, and maybe more important, her hubby, that it wasn't really theirs. Archer went to his room and wrote everything down he could remember about their conversation. Then he quickly undressed and got into bed in his skivvies and with his socks still on. He slept like a dead man for more than 8 hours, and awoke with bright afternoon sunlight dipping its toe into his room. Shit. He jumped out of bed, put on his robe, and headed to the communal bath at the end of the hall with his soap, scrubber, and shave kit. The water was lukewarm, and by the smell of it, he wasn't sure it wasn't being piped in directly from the ocean. He dried off, combed his wet hair, and shaved in the humidity of the tiny room, where he had to keep rubbing the fog off the round mirror. Finished, he put his robe back on and opened the door to find Callahan, standing there in a sheer black number and white fluffy slippers, and holding a shower cap and a scrub brush, along with a small leather toiletry kit.
Wow, you're up bright and early, Archer,
she said sarcastically. Look who's talking. She rubbed his jaw with her hand.
You're all nice and clean and shaved.
And a little salty, yeah.
Where were you last night?
In bed. She lightly slapped that shaved jaw.
Don't lie to me. You went out.
How do you know that?
I got eyes and ears, and I saw you come back with the little dish and the convertible in the middle of the night, like Cinderella getting dumped from the pumpkin.
That little dish is Beth Kemper, the wife of my client.
So why are you out with her in the middle of the night, and not your client?
It's a long story.
You couldn't sleep?
Not after what happened, no. But I understood you were sleeping like a baby.
I was, until I wasn't. Are you sleeping with her, Archer?
I don't sleep with married women, even unhappily married ones.
Says you, chump. And as a reminder, I'm not married, and I'm happy as a clam.
She used her hip to bump him out of the doorway, and she closed the door in his face. He walked back to his room and dressed meticulously, down to his pocket square. He put his PI license in his jacket pocket, clipped the .38 to his belt, and drove out to the same diner near the wharf where they served breakfast all day. He ordered coffee and 2 over-easy eggs with crispy bacon, toast, and orange juice, which he knew they made in California in abundance. He laid out the map of Baytown on the table and started going over it, but this time with a different focus. He was looking at the water instead of the land. He didn't know how far out Armstrong had gone in the boat, but common sense told him it couldn't have been too far. They sure weren't going to Hawaii in a boat that size. His breakfast came, and he ate and drank while he studied the map.
"What are you doing, Mr. Archer?"
He turned to see Madame Genevieve standing next to him, clutching a sack about the size of his old army duffel. "Just learning more about the town. What are you doing here?" She held up the sack.
"I was at the dock buying fish for dinner tonight from a vendor, and saw you through the window."
She sat down across from him.
"You know, for $2 more per day, you get breakfast and supper at my place. I make a better breakfast than they do here. And I get my fish fresh for dinner, as I just told you."
He lit a cigarette and nodded. "Thanks, I'll sure keep that in mind." He glanced at the map and then back at her. "Hey, how well do you know this area?"
"What do you want to know?"
He stabbed the Pacific with his finger. "What's off the coast here that a person could get to relatively fast by boat? I know about the northern and southern Channel Islands. Anacapa's the closest to the coast, but it's still about 12 miles out and over an hour by boat. And it's about an hour and a half boat ride to Santa Cruz. The others are a lot farther out, up to 70 miles or so. Anything closer than that?" Madame Genevieve studied the map for a few moments.
"I do remember hearing about an island that was built about 3 miles out, so you could get there in about 15 or 20 minutes in a fast boat, depending on the sea conditions."
He looked at her strangely as his smoke dangled from his mouth. "Wait a sec. You said an island that was built?"
"During the war, the military took over the Channel Islands, but they needed more capacity for some sort of special work. There was a very shallow spot about 3 miles directly out from here, where the land was just at the surface. The military built upon that base of earth to make a new island there."
"Who owns that piece of rock now?"
"I suppose the military still does. Why all the interest?"
"Just curious."
"I suppose all good private eyes are."
"We can assume that, yeah."
"Where did you go last night?"
"Just out for a walk. Found this place and had some coffee."
"And now you go to work as a detective?"
"That's right. A very tardy detective." He folded up his map and put it in his pocket. "See you later." He put down money for his meal, tipped his hat, and left. She watched him every step of the way. Chapter 38.
"Hey, Seamus, how's it going?"
said Earl, as Archer stepped into the elevator car. "It's going faster than I thought."
"Got you a juicy murder to work on?"
said the little man as he closed the gate and hit the button for the fourth floor. He had on his uniform with the shirt untucked, and Archer spied a half-empty bottle of Southern Comfort tucked behind his fold-up seat.
"Why'd he say that?"
Earl cackled.
"Afternoon edition of the Gazette. Gal killed at midnight moves. You working on that?"
"It's confidential."
"Yeah, I thought so, all right. Now don't you go get sliced and diced, Archer. Lot of that going around, it seems."
"I'll do my best."
The car clanked to a stop and he got off. He looked back to see Earl leaning out of the car and watching him like Archer was about to combust, and the man didn't want to miss the spectacle. Connie Morrison looked up from her desk as Archer walked into the office of Willie Dash, very private investigations.
"Hey, sorry I'm late, Connie,
she interrupted.
"Willie is in his office. He wants to see you. Right now."
Her tone was a bit severe, and her tight hair bun pulled her eyes back to such a degree that Archer wasn't sure if she was glaring at him or merely reacting to the pressure on her hair.
"Everything okay?" said Archer.
"Just go see him, Archer."
Archer hooked his hat on the wall peg, buttoned his suit jacket, and rapped on Dash's door.
"Come,"
said the voice. He opened the door and walked in. Dash was behind his desk, his jacket off and his sleeves rolled up to his elbows. His black toupee lay next to him, its wisps of hair sticking up like the man's finger had met a light socket while he was wearing it. He took off his steel-rimmed spectacles and eyed Archer.
"Grab a seat, Archer, and let me finish this letter for Connie to get out."
Archer sat and waited patiently while Dash's ballpoint skated in cursive across the paper. Done, Dash rose, left the room with the paper, and came back a minute later without it. It was in his socks. Archer looked around the room for the bottle of Beam, but didn't see it. The wall bed was nestled all snug up in the wall. He looked at Dash's eyes and saw not a trace of drunken red. Dash sat down and eyed Archer right back.
No, I did not sleep here, and no, I have not been hitting the bottle. And yes, I know my toupee looks like a Sherman tank ran over it. Fact is, it blew off and landed in a ditch where a squirrel decided it was his new best friend.
Keen eye, Willie. Sherlock Holmes has nothing on you. Dash adjusted his plastic suspenders, smoothed down his shirt, and glanced at his watch.
You have a funny idea of a work day.
I know I'm sorry, but I was out really late doing some sleuthing. He paused and then let loose with his change-up pitch. Ruby Fraser is dead.
Yeah, I heard.
Archer looked deflated. Okay.
And you and your friend were at Midnight Moods last night?
How'd you hear about that?
I hear lots of things, Archer. What were you doing there?
My friend was auditioning for a job, which she got, and I went there to talk to Ruby again. I planned to have a second go at her. And when I got back here yesterday, Connie had my ticket ready and said I was to basically have at it, that you trusted me. Was she selling me a line or what?
Connie doesn't sell lines, so just drop the hurt feelings crap, compose yourself, and tell me what you did after we parted ways yesterday.
Archer went through the whole gamut, from A to Z, going to see Sheen and getting the list of names from him, driving to Midnight Moods with Callahan, and then Archer got around to telling Dash about finding Fraser.
So you walked in and there she was, dead?
And then I phoned the cops from the lobby without identifying myself.
You might have put you, me, and this agency in jeopardy, Archer.
So you would have volunteered your name to the cops?
No, I'm not saying that. But did anyone see you and the lady go in or out? Because if they did, you two might be looking down the barrel of a murder charge, or at the very least intent to obstruct a police investigation.
I don't see how I obstructed anything. But for me, they would have found Fraser a lot later than they did. Dash stroked his chin.
What you say makes perfect sense, only some coppers have never quite grasped that concept. So you found Fraser dead, but no sign of anyone having been in her place.
Right.
Okay. You called the cops. Then what?
I went back to the boarding house where I'm staying.
And then?
I went to sleep.
I thought you said you had a late night. Hell, when I was your age, late to me was the next morning. But you got up and came here in the afternoon? So that was what? About 13 hours worth of shut-eye?
Dash stopped talking, and eyeballed him in a way that was making Archer wish he'd driven through Baytown and kept going right into the ocean.
Before you say anything, Archer, keep in mind that if you lie to me, and I'll know if you are, you're fired.
I couldn't sleep. I went for a walk and ended up at a diner, where I saw Mrs. Kemper.
What time was this?
Around 3 in the morning.
What was Beth Kemper doing at a diner at 3 a.m.?
Having a cup of coffee and a cigarette. She said she has a place to stay in town, had it before she was married. So I don't think she went back up the mountain last night.
How did you get home? Walk?
She gave me a lift. Let me check my notes. He pulled out his pad and consulted the pages, while Dash watched him with grudging approval. She said her old man told her about Ruby. I told her she might be a suspect, since Fraser might have been sleeping with her husband, and they might assume she knew about it. But she said she had an alibi.
What was it?
Asked Dash sharply. She was at dinner with friends from 5 to midnight. She wouldn't tell me who with. She doesn't know where her husband was during that time. When I went over to his office to get the list, I don't think he was there.
You found Ruby's body when exactly?
10 minutes to 12. I looked at my watch. One more thing. Ruby died from someone almost cutting her head off, but there was no blood around the body.
Meaning she was killed elsewhere. Did you check out her rooms?
There was nothing anywhere. So she was killed somewhere else and her body carried to her room. Tell me how the hell does somebody not see that? Dash took this all in and then focused on Archer's facial injuries.
Who beat you up?
Right, forgot about that. Armstrong's boys did the pummeling. He was at Midnight Moods. He wanted to hire us to find out the truth behind the blackmail. I told him I'd have to take that up with you, and that we already had a client paying us for pretty much the same thing. He didn't like it that we went to talk to his daughter. He made me show him the list of suspects I got from Wilson Sheen. And maybe I said some things they didn't like, and fists started flying and we got into it.
For starters, Archer, Douglas Kemper did not hire us to find the truth. I'm not sure what he did hire us to do, but I'm certain it wasn't that.
Okay. But I also told Beth that her husband would be a suspect. She didn't know if he had an alibi or not.
Oh, so it's Beth now?
We had a cup of coffee last night. I saved her from a trio of punks. She was grateful.
I bet she was. Only you don't want that kind of gratitude. And how does anyone know they have an alibi if no one knows when the woman was killed?
Beth said the police do. Her old man told her so.
Sawyer Armstrong told her when? You found the body at 11:50. You called the cops. They came while you hightailed it. You said Beth was at dinner until midnight. Then she left, went somewhere, and then ended up in the diner at 3 a.m. So when did Armstrong tell her? And when and how did he find out?
Despite the risk, Archer could not bring himself to tell Dash about seeing Kemper and her father together down near the wharf, when Sawyer Armstrong might very well have told his daughter about Ruby Fraser. I don't know. Maybe he phoned her. And she said he's friends with Carl Pickett, the chief of police. Dash sat back and mulled this over.
That could be. Carl Pickett is as big a brown noser as they come. But why would he give Armstrong the heads up about Ruby?
He might if he knew there was a connection between Ruby and Douglas Kemper. Dash put out a hand.
Let me see the list Wilson Sheen gave you.
Archer handed it across, and Dash ran his eye down the page.
I don't see much here, Archer. Looks to me more like a keep-us-busy list.
So they want to keep us busy so we won't look where we're really supposed to look? This is a funny town.
I'm getting funnier by the minute. Let's take a walk.
Chapter 39. The sun was shining, and the breakers could be clearly heard. What looked to be a golden eagle soared above them with dizzying grace and power, while a black and white osprey spread its wings in another part of the sky and abruptly changed its vector to the ocean side, as the bird no doubt went in search of lunch. Dash had glued on his toupee before topping it with his hat. They walked for quite a few blocks in silence. One of Dash's shoes became untied as they crossed Sawyer Avenue and turned down De La Guerra Street. Dash stopped and bent down to lace it back up. Cars passed them and ladies window shopping graced them with smiles, even as a beggar rumbled through in his near rags, hat in hand, to see what he could get from the women. What he got were stern looks, tosses of hatted, refined heads, and sharp waves away. He headed toward Archer with not a hopeful look. Archer handed him a half dollar, and the gent ambled on with a smile.
Booze, you know, said Dash.
Let's be optimistic. Maybe some soup. Surprised to see him on the rich side of town.
He's doing what we're doing, following the money. You read up on this place before you came here, Archer?
Not really.
A good Seamus needs to know the lay of the land, the people who matter here. And I don't mean that everybody doesn't matter, but the way the world works, there are two kinds of people. Those with money and or power, and those with neither one. And those with money and power have one thing in common. They can never get enough of either one.
Okay.
The Chumash people were here before any white folks. They had villages all over. This was hundreds and hundreds of years ago, you understand? Then the Spaniards came along in the 1700s to settle the area and to also fortify it. They tried to convert the Chumash to worship God. Not sure how well that worked out. But what the Spaniards brought was smallpox, and that came real close to wiping out the Chumash. So I guess if you can't convert them, you can kill them. After that, the Mexicans came along and knocked out the Spanish, and their flag flew over this town, but not for very long. That's why you have the street names you do here, like the one we're on, De La Guerra. And then there's Carrillo, Torres, Alonso, Hernandez, Navarro, Gonzalez. The list goes on and on.
But not the most important one, namely Sawyer, said Archer.
Right. Here's how that came about. The Mexican governors gave out land grants to prominent folks around here, like the Armstrongs. They did it to make them loyal and to cultivate allies. That's when the rancho period started here. And those ranchos were used for cattle raising,
and then they'd ship the cattle out for slaughter, and the meat went all over. Beth said her grandfather Atticus was in that business, and she also said he got out and went into real estate. And you mentioned that the Armstrongs got out of the cattle business before it all went to hell. What happened?
A drought is what happened, Archer, like nobody'd ever seen before. And cows drink a lot of water. Now Baytown and Santa Barbara and other places in the region fell to the Americans when John C. Fremont came calling with a bunch of armed soldiers. A peace treaty was signed, and this was no longer Mexican dirt. It was a dangerous place back in the gold rush days. Every sort of criminal type headed this way before the gold petered out. Then the Armstrong Wharf was built in the early 1900s, and that made Baytown both a commercial and tourist town. Then the railroad came along and connected us to San Fran to the north and the City of Angels to the south. Now all things are in place for the town to really take off.
Armstrong Wharf, huh?
Atticus Armstrong built it, and Sawyer made a lot of improvements to it, bringing in new cranes and warehouse space. Everybody in town knows who they owe for that.
How'd they make their money after the cattle business died?
Let's just say the Armstrong family knew how to relieve men of their dollars, whether it be by gambling, women, whiskey, or the long barrel of a gun. Then they discovered oil and gas out there in the bay. You can see the derricks pumping, and you got the drilling operations down near the pier.
Do the Armstrongs own that, too?
They have their fingers in every pie, Archer.
Archer looked out toward the water and thought back to the night before with Sawyer Armstrong in that boat.
So the point of the history lesson?
If you know the history of a place, you're not doomed to repeat the mistakes of others who came before you, Archer.
And what mistakes are those?
Thinking you can hobnob with the likes of Beth Kemper and get away unscathed. You can't, and you won't. And I didn't get you that damn PI license just to see you end up in the ocean where the water's over your head.
He looked at Archer's injuries.
It won't be bruises next time. It'll be something more permanent.
Archer kept his gaze on that very same water.
What's this I hear about some island out there the military built and now owns?
Who told you about that?
I forget. But what's the deal?
It's a chunk of rock with no more purpose in life.
Okay. Mrs. Kemper told me about her mother's plane crash.
Dash's manner grew subdued.
Yeah. Eleanor Armstrong was a fine woman. Tragic accident.
Her body was never recovered?
The wreckage was, but no, she wasn't. There are sharks out there, Archer, and other sea critters that just look at a body as a meal.
And what caused the crash?
Some folks said they heard the engine cut off and the plane went into a dive. She never had a chance.
I guess Sawyer Armstrong was real cut up about that.
I'm not sure that man has the emotions of a regular person, Archer. But for now, we have a case to work.
Well, if the list Sheen gave us is crap, what do we do?
We focus on Ruby Fraser, which means we need to go have a chat with the police.
Your buddy Carl Pickett?
I never said we were buddies, Archer. Did I?
Chapter 40. The Baytown police station was located in a large one-story cream-colored stucco building, with thick, curved orange terracotta roof tiles to keep out the rain, and enough wrought iron railing to keep the blast furnaces in Pittsburgh in business. Archer noted the four prowlers slant parked out front, and the string of uniformed cops in their dark blue uniforms, chest straps, big holstered revolvers, black boots, and crisp, short-brimmed caps who lurked near the entrance. Two motorcycle officers were astride their Harley-Davidsons and passing the time with two young, pretty women in dark skirts, tight blouses, and high heels. Dash led him inside to the front desk, where a burly man about 6'4", with shoulders as wide as a doorway and sergeant stripes down his sleeve, sat in front of the large duty book in which he was carefully marking entries in pen.
"Steve Pritchard," said Dash. "Long time no see."
Pritchard looked up, and his expression told Archer that the cop would have preferred the no-see part going on indefinitely.
"What do you want, Dash?"
Dash smiled.
"Is Carl in?"
"No."
Dash's smile broadened.
"No, really, or just not for me?"
"There's been a murder, or maybe you hadn't heard," growled Pritchard.
taking a look at Archer and coming away unimpressed. Fresh meat, Willie? This one looks underfed.
He's okay. And that murder is why we're here, said Dash.
Pritchard perked up at this.
Is that so? What's your interest?
I'd rather talk to Carl about that. Professional courtesy, you understand.
He's up at Midnight Moods looking into it. That's where the dame was killed.
All right, guess we'll take a ride over there.
He hooked a thumb at Archer.
And this is my new associate, Archer.
Who cares?
Pritchard said, turning back to the pages of the duty book. Archer looked over the man's shoulder and saw two photos on the wall. One was of President Harry Truman, and for the other he had to read the name on a brass plate at the bottom. Governor Earl Warren. As they walked out of the police station, Archer commented,
Boy, Willie, you got them wrapped around your little finger in that place.
Let's go get that car of yours and take a run over to Midnight Moods.
Is Pickett any friendlier to you than Pritchard was?
Oh, me and Steve Pritchard are good buddies. Play cards once a week over hooch and cigars, and spin tales about women we took to bed, none of which are true.
And I wouldn't want to see how he acts around somebody he doesn't like.
I'm joshing you, Archer. He's my friend like Hitler was Roosevelt's. Same with Pickett.
Okay.
And unlike Armstrong's cronies, Big Steve hits where it doesn't show. He's got more confessions that way than any cop on the force. And if you were colored or Mexican, you usually didn't live long enough to sign that confession.
And they let him get away with that?
Get away with it? It's in the playbook, Archer. Big Steve just does it better than anyone else. Hell, son, didn't they teach you anything in prison?
On the drive over to Midnight Moods, Dash patted the door of the Delahaye.
Now this is a fine machine, Archer. Puts a spring in my step just riding in it.
Glad I could do that for you. What do you hope to accomplish at Midnight Moods?
I want to get in to see Ruby's room. Then I want to talk to folks who might have seen something last night. We need to narrow the time window down to see who might be suspects and who might not.
I guess they'll do an autopsy on her body.
Yes, they will. I know the county coroner, Mortimer Wallace. He's a good man.
Is he a doctor?
No, but he owns a funeral home and he's got experience doing the cutting. From what you told me, it doesn't sound like the cause of death will be a tough one here.
But can he tell us when she died?
Within reasonable parameters, Archer. It won't be to the minute. But we spoke with Ruby earlier that day. Other people will have seen her after we did. We can narrow it down that way if Mortimer can't be real specific. It's the only way we check alibis. Now, how long do you reckon she was dead when you saw her?
She was cold.
How about her arms? Starting to get stiff yet?
No, they were soft as putty.
So no rigor mortis, then.
He eyed Archer.
Body starts to get all stiff after death, but it takes a while for it to happen. Then you can't bend an arm or leg without breaking bones.
Well, I can tell you she wasn't in rigor mortis then. Nowhere close.
Dash snapped his fingers.
Wait a minute. When was her act last night?
Oh, I forgot to tell you. She didn't show up for it. So my friend did the singing instead.
What time was she supposed to be on again?
10. The thing is, Mabel Dawson said they went to look for Ruby, but she wasn't in her room. This was probably around 9:30 or so.
Okay, so she was somewhere else getting murdered.
Seems like it.
Who's your friend again?
Liberty Callahan. She drove with me from Reno. She's a singer and a dancer, wants to be an actress in Hollywood.
Her and every other dame. Think she's got a shot?
If anyone does, yeah.
When they reached Midnight Moods, two prowlers and a Chrysler as big as a tank were parked together next to the front entrance.
That green Chrysler Town and Country belongs to Pickett, said Dash as they passed it. Small dick, big car. I found that to be far more accurate than the weather forecast.
Does he actually go out to all the murders?
Damn, Archer. How many homicides do you think we have around here?
I don't know. I was in a little town in the middle of nowhere, and we had 3 in a matter of a few days.
You weren't responsible for any of them, were you?
Only one. But it was self-defense.
Dash stopped and eyed him.
Well, well. Am I going to have to reconsider my opinion of you, Archer?
Depends on whether that opinion will get better or worse if you do.
You keep surprising me, Archer. You surely do.
Is that good?
I'll let you know. They ducked inside to see a lawman.